She's April.
And she's Molly.
And we are
the Book Besties. If they're going to read books about fairies fucking, then they have to be okay with this.
Well, only if you're enjoying it. If you're not, I don't want to know. There's like dinosaur sex, unicorn sex.
But the man is 79. He likes the books with the sex in them.
Get a view into my sex life.
Oh, I've never been to a professional day in my life. With our new friend!
With our new friend, AJ West!
Hi.
Welcome, welcome!
What's
also, I should not drink lemonade before I try to sing the Book Besties, because apparently that ain't it. My voice cracked.
Why? What happened? I'd missed that. Was there a little lemonade burp come out?
No, my voice cracked when I tried to go up. We don't have a theme song. I just sing. For no reason.
We're not Bailey Sarian. We're not
You just belch words. That's what you do. You just burp words.
Yeah. And it would be very goes,
this is Book Besties podcast.
Out of the two of us, I am very capable of that. We don't do that on air though.
Yeah.
Because you'd be surprised how much people don't like my volume. They think I'm a little too loud. Which
we've got
IRL, not gonna lie, I am. I am a little loud, but it comes with the ADHD and the personality. So, grain of salt and all that, friends.
It's fine.
You've got a lovely voice. I love your voice. I do. I've in the past, I've done some voiceover work for adverts and things. And so, and I was a producer in radio for years. And so I kind of got used to listening to people's voices. I don't know how to put it, like detaching voices from faces in a funny way. Like I like to just listen to someone's voice and how they shape words and you've got a lovely voice. Most people
have
nice voices. The people who don't, the people who don't have nice voices tend to be the people who speak the most.
That's me, actually. I speak a lot.
He's not wrong about that.
That's true. That's also true. I'm gonna go on a tirade for a second. AJ, I had no idea you were on Big Brother.
We found out. We found out last week too, because we interviewed Hazel Gaynor, and I asked her if she knew who you were, and she told us that she had done an event that you were also at, and she said something about you being on Big Brother, and we were like, wow.
Oh my God. And then you posted that video.
And you posted the clip.
That crazy clip. Yeah, I know. Yeah,
I'm a super fan. Like, I started watching back in the day as a teenager, so it's a goal for me to always be on. So the fact that you've been on is amazing. Congratulations. Happy for you.
It was a very surreal thing to do, you know, because I started watching it when I was a teenager, and I don't know, it's impossible to explain to people, but I remember the day when, you know, we'd been kept in hiding for a week, and then we had to stay in, I had this really cool chaperone, but he was into like Japanese samurai films. I had a week of not being able to, I couldn't watch telly, I couldn't read newspapers, I couldn't
do anything. He's just talking to you about these old Japanese films.
Like, samurai films. I ran out within 5 minutes of everything I had to say. I was like, I've watched Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon once. That's it. That's as far as I go. And I've heard of three. Imagine after like 5 days. And then there were 2 days in a hotel where you weren't allowed to leave your room, so you were stuck in a hotel room. And then I was just sitting in
there. No wonder you started writing.
Well, right. So I was sitting in the back of this car with noise-cancelling headphones on and a blindfold, and then being led by my arm, and you could hear, like, whispering around, and it was such a strange thing. And then suddenly to have the blindfold whipped off and the earphones removed, and then just everything was lights and screaming. The doors opened in front of me, like, right next to my nose, right up close. I couldn't even focus. And then they opened and it was just screaming and lights. And it was the first moment, like after all of this time kind of being told I was going to be on this show, I suddenly found myself on the set, you know, walking down the stairs to the set with these crazy people inside this house. And I was there for 8 weeks. And it's amazing how you get used to it.
I don't enough to live with people I don't know. I don't always like living with the people I live with. And I know them. And I created two of them. So
it's like living in a bubble, and you don't realize you're living in that bubble till you're outside of it, right? And it's just wild to see how people react in and out of the house and how they react to the fame afterwards. And you're so just calm and mild-mannered, and it's nice to see somebody come out of it and not want to die.
Well, I wouldn't say, I came out of it with problems, you know, definitely psychological issues. I mean, it was a tough thing to be in there, you know, for 8 weeks. Yeah. I went back to being a boy at primary school. I was bullied. I was quite tearful a lot of the time. I was Big Brother. The producers were constantly sending information in that were implying to me and my housemates that people outside didn't like me. And actually I was, you know,
what am I beating up?
I was liked, but I remember it was like maybe kind of 5 weeks in or something, and I started having really, really bad panic attacks, and
sweetheart.
And it was the eviction night, and you have to sit there and you're not allowed to leave for like 2 hours. You have to sit on the chair.
That's a long night.
Well, it's long because you've got these people who you've been living with who you kind of hate, but at the same time
You have to pretend, you have to be on.
And you have to be on, and you can't leave. So it's, you really feel trapped. And then you hear the outside world for the first time. People are screaming, and you imagine you're hearing things. But they rushed me to the diary room this one night, because I really was like, I was like shouting out to Big Brother saying, I've got to go. I'm leaving. You know, I've had enough. After all of this time, I kind of was broken. Mm. But they took me into the diary room, and this paramedic came in, this lady paramedic. Mm. And she leaned into my ear and just whispered in my ear, you're loved. Mm-hmm. And she kind of pulled back, and she was like, I've got these for you, like some calms, just some herbal medicines.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
She said, I've told them what he needs to hear. He just needs to hear that all of the stuff you've been saying to him for all these weeks isn't actually
true. They were in your head. They were playing with you, because they storyboard. I've been researching reality shows for my current book I'm working on. And the fact that they storyboard while you guys are in there, right? Mm-hmm. They have a way they want this show to go before they even start filming. So for them to do that to you is cruel and awful. And I'm really sorry. And again, I will beat up anyone you want. That is my guarantee as your friend. I am the violent one.
I understand your desire to defend people, but let's not make it an international incident. Like, I feel
just once, flying overseas.
You know, I don't need you. I don't need you to beat anyone up. But actually, I think it's nice. It was nice, getting out, and for people who, like, you really find out who your friends are. And I made some new friends, but I stayed made some really bad friends. It's, you know, if you're writing about this subject, it's what happens. And I have to say quickly, by the way, you know, I put myself on the show, right? Like, you know what it is. Yeah. So I'm not playing victim, right? There's no violins playing for me. You go through it, you do it, you make the best of it. But I tell you what, it's life afterwards that's the difficulty with any of those shows, because they can really only make the storyboards after a certain point when it's Big Brother.
Right.
Out of who you are and what you're actually doing, because they can't script you while you're in there. So they can put you in situations, but you're the person who's in charge of. And that was a really important lesson for me to learn, that actually under extreme pressure, I always tried at least to stay true to my principles. And I was quite good at judging character. But then when I left, my principles, my judge of character, my sense of who friends were and weren't, just disappeared for it was about a year and a half where I just went into, I don't mind saying, I've said it before, I went into drink, and there was drugs, and you know, I was not sleeping, and I was very, you know, just emotionally mixed up, and you know, wasn't my best self, I guess you could say. And that's the thing that sticks with me when I have those moments where you just put your hands in your, you know, you put your face in your hands and you just think back to your most embarrassing worst moments. It's not the TV show, it's afterwards.
Well, are you better now?
I struggle to sleep in silence, but I'm getting better now. So normally I have to play something, because when you're sleeping in the house, they wake you up with like screaming babies and drill sounds. One night they woke us up rattling our beds and banging against the walls and looking through the mirrors in the walls. And they had a person stood at the end of every bed in this really horrible, scary kind of futuristic mask with eyes peering out. And it never went on television, I guess, because I think it messed us up.
It was too traumatizing.
It was too traumatizing. But it's stuff like that that kind of messed up my sleep. So that I struggle with.
Love. But I think, I'm really sorry.
Also, Well, and there's kind of, you know, trust issues and things, but anyway, my husband's been very good for me. I mean, he kind of saved me at my lowest point.
Yeah.
He's been amazing.
That hurts my heart.
And yeah. I'm sorry I brought it up then, because that's traumatizing for you. I apologize.
No, not at all.
So do you want to talk about something that traumatized us? Because we could.
Yes, let's trade trauma.
So your book, The Betrayal of Thomas True, it came out in the United States in January of this year, right? And it came out in the UK when?
July of last year.
Okay. Yeah. And the paperback is now on sale in the UK. Pre-sale.
So it's coming out on July 3rd, 2020. What year is it? 2025.
Five. And it has beautiful, like, purple edges. It's, like, pretty. And I'm like, I may have to pay international tariffs and get that.
You know, it kind of kills me. It kills me seeing you there with your hardbacks, and it hasn't got the, has it got the peacock? It hasn't got the peacock pages.
No, it doesn't. No.
No. But it's pretty. AJ,
we got these for free. So
these are beautiful. These are beautiful. Don't take away from the beauty of this book.
I absolutely love this. We love a map too. We love a map.
Well, I know. I said, because, you know, in real, no jokes, that map, I spent like a year and a half staring at that map, writing the book, working out all the little snickets and lanes they would have taken in real life. It's a real map, you know, from the 1700s.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of the places that they walk, all of the routes that they take, I timed them walking around London today because they're all still there.
I really appreciated this page too, where you have the Mollies with their Molly name and their actual name or their given name. I had to refer to it a few times because they're totally different when they get to be themselves as Mollies. Mm-hmm. And I was like, who is that guy again? I had to go back. And it was very helpful. I'm actually reading a book right now that I'm like, I would love that for this book.
I'm not forgiving you for this image. I'm actually really mad at you about that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Why? Why?
You know why, mister. You know why, mister. You made me cry a lot.
So I finished this book a week ago and I just texted her and was like, I'm not okay. I started crying probably the last like hour I was reading the book and then cried for a full hour after. I was like doing my journal and doing my Goodreads review and just sobbing. And my husband is like, what's happening right now? And I was like, it's a book. I don't know.
I got to the first round of Hangings and I'm like, cause I parallel read because of the dyslexia.
Listen and read at the same time.
Yeah. And I'm like, I just closed the book and I'm like, and my husband's like, what's wrong? And I go, everybody's dead. And he goes, I don't want to know if you're crying this much. And I go, you don't understand. Everyone is dead, Matt. And he goes, what are you talking about?
Not everyone. We're not giving you spoilers. Not everyone.
I was just so like, I was a mess,
so,
AJ.
So,
I'm a mess, what man? I'm still a mess. How dare you?
Can I give your bio and then we'll have you give a synopsis of your book?
Actually talk about the book? I'm sorry.
You can give my bio. I just need to say to anyone watching this, when we hear the phrase, you really are you really crying?
No, my eyelashes were, I watered up a little bit.
She's
sorry.
Not right now.
I watered up because remembering. Sorry.
When you hear the phrase, the first round of hangings, like, I mean, that does kind of give an impression that the book is like really super gory. It's, you know,
it's got so much humor.
You know, it's love and light. But anyway, bio, go.
There's also this fantasy in this book, too.
Yeah.
I don't think you understand how much fantasy you bring in. Like, there's a sense of magic for me in this book that I don't get from historical fiction.
Yeah, but anymore. Molly, do you know how controversial that is?
No.
I mean, it's so like, one of the publishers that turned me down said one of the reasons they did so is because of the Blackguard children and the kind of fantasy element therein.
No.
And, you know, if you I do read reviews. I don't read all reviews, but I scan some reviews and there are people who are like, I took 2 stars off it because it got a bit far-fetched or a bit fantastical. I'm like, no, do you know what? If you immerse yourself in this world, mm-hmm. it is a fantasy world. The whole point of the Molly House is it was a fantasy world.
Fucking metaphor, you assholes. Listen
if
to
they're
me.
Gonna read books about, if they're going to read books about fairies fucking, then they have to be okay with this because this is at least realistic.
Children were ignored. It was a metaphor for the fact that we fucking ignored kids. Eat shit, people.
Okay,
I'll
Molly.
Go on all of Goodreads for you.
Okay, Molly, calm down. Calm down.
Sorry,
we're 15 minutes in and we haven't even given a bio yet. Come on.
Welcome to Book Besties, friends.
Where the questions don't matter and everything is made
up. Points are made up. Yep.
So A.J. West's second novel, The Betrayal of Thomas True, which is what we're talking about today, was an instant Sunday Times bestseller, while his debut novel, The Spirit Engineer, was awarded the HWA Debut Crown Award. Mm-hmm. He is an award-winning former BBC TV newsreader and reporter and appears regularly on national television and radio programs discussing books, history, and current affairs. And today I opened your open TikTok and you had a video posted where you were talking about some history and doing a voiceover. And I was like, oh my gosh, I want to mm-hmm. live in the world where this voice is. So yeah. I'm very excited to have you here.
Same.
Well, here I am.
So can you give us a synopsis for The Betrayal of Thomas True?
No.
Cool.
Next question.
Cool. I guess ass. I'll move on.
No one ever said that before. No, the truth is, I find
Hazel has actually.
Hazel says no, thank you. No, thank you.
I don't want to do it.
Everyone says if they're giving advice to authors and that, you've got to really work on your elevator pitch. You've got to mm-hmm. be able to sum up your book mm-hmm. in one sentence. And I guess you could sum it up by saying, I don't know, it's a thriller. Romantic mystery in the gay underworld of Georgian London, I guess is the kind of the summary.
Yeah,
but there's not really, there's kind of like a lot to it. You know, there's basically you have Gabriel and Thomas. They're two very different guys. They're mm-hmm. both struggling with the fact that they're gay, to use the modern term for it. And they are part of the Molly culture in Georgian London, which is kind of the mm-hmm. gay underground. And they mm-hmm. realize that one of their friends from the Molly House has to be the Rat, who's mm-hmm. a secret snitch, who's giving their names away to a pair of murderous justices. Because the fact of the matter is, in 1700s London, in the real world, in those days, you did have guys going to these secret gay meeting places or queer meeting places, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And pretending to be queer and then giving their names away for money or for whatever reason, or for their, you know, for their religious reasons, or, you know, and men were hanged. So mm-hmm. it was a kind of, it's a thriller, and it's an adventure. It's a mystery. It's got elements of fantasy. It's a romance. And I'm really proud of it. It was hard to write. Yeah. Trust me. If you shed some tears reading it, imagine how many tears I shed for a year and a half writing it.
I can't even imagine.
This
has to be super personal for you.
Yeah.
You know, and taking it on. I hope you had an excellent therapist, sweetheart.
Yes.
Well, I have my husband who does an Olympic level eye roll. So that tends to
good work. Enough.
That's all
good
we
enough.
Need.
The English equivalent of therapy is having your partner roll their eyes at you. Give you a glass of wine.
I'm too American for a British partner, I've just learned. Got it.
That's why we're all such a mess. I shed tears kind of writing some of the really emotional stuff. Mm-hmm. I shed tears saying goodbye to the characters when I finished the book. But mm-hmm. I also shed kind of happy tears. I'm a crier anyway, but I laughed and grinned ear to ear writing this book, and I just found the whole kind of world fascinating, and to live there felt like such such an honor. And I know that sounds insincere, but I mean it. I still live there in my mind. Yeah. You know, I wish
it's
I could
magical.
Go back.
And
terrifying at the same time.
I was messaging you on Instagram as I was reading along, and I don't do that. Like, I know that that's going to sound like, oh, well, you know, you're just trying to talk up the authors. Promise you, when it comes to this podcast, I'm the one that's brutally honest. Like, in life, it's Molly. I'm the nice sugar. She's not.
I treat authors nice because I'm an author and I want to be treated nicely.
But I'm a librarian, and so I face things like a consumer. So I'm like, if it's not good, I will talk to the author, but I'm not going to hype them up. So me messaging you along the way and telling you about how I was laughing out loud and how I was really getting into it, how I was literally annotating this book. Literally have like highlights throughout this book where I was just like so impressed with parts. Like, that is not me hyping you up. That's how I felt about this book.
This will be a book Bessie's favorite for a while, babe.
And you have to know this, AJ. Historical fiction is my least favorite genre.
No. Time out.
She hates it. For me to really love this book is huge. Okay. And we recently finished Last Night at the Telegraph Club by Melinda Lowe. Or Lowe. I'm not actually sure how you see her last name. But it is about...
I was saying Lowe.
It's about... lesbian culture in what was it, the 70s?
San Francisco. In
San Francisco.
Starting in 1954.
And it's a YA book. It was not my favorite book we've read, but what I liked about it is it was a person of color, which we do not get often in queer stories. It was a teen story, which I started as a teacher, a high school teacher. And when I became a librarian, I became a children's librarian specifically because I wanted to advocate for more books with diverse characters. And so for those reasons, it does. So for those reasons, I support that book. It just wasn't my favorite, but it was such an interesting change of pace to see, okay, this is the American history of one group of people in San Francisco, which is actually my uncle. He's passed now, but when he graduated high school, he went to San Francisco and, you know, was going to finally get to be himself. So that's like my connection to it. And then to see how this was in England, and particularly because, I mean, people were literally killed for who they loved, which is just an absurd thought.
Disgusting.
It's awful. And so I loved this book so much. I loved it so much. It's definitely one of my top of the season for sure. And
we will be talking about this book on Pod for a while.
Yeah.
And we'll be promoting it for a long bit because this story is important, sweetheart. I know you know that because you wouldn't have fucking wrote it if you didn't think it was important, but we're going to be shouting it from the rooftops too.
Yeah.
Because.
Well, it's important to me on so many levels. I'll try and list kind of some of them briefly, but you know, obviously I'm a gay guy. So in that sense, but writing about.
This is new information for me.
Yeah, I do. I like dick.
Me too.
When I was.
Same, but I kind of also like girls' boobs. So weird me.
I appreciate girls' boobs, but I tend to be reassuring my girlfriend
after I married a guy.
I tend to be reassuring about my girlfriends asking me about their boobs than actually showing. You know. Anyway,
we appreciate that.
I loved writing about Thomas's childhood because it was making me think about how, as a boy, how I was coming to terms with who I was and how I didn't fit in with the other boys and that stuff. So that was very personal. But one of the other things I really loved writing about, aside from, well, two things, and it's, do you know, I sometimes think maybe I shouldn't say this, but then I think it is important to me and it is important to the book. So I do say it, but I just hope people understand why I'm saying it and the way I'm saying it, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's I don't, as a gay guy, like creative stuff where just because you're queer, you're automatically perfect. Because my experience is not that, right?
Yeah.
So some of the most bullying, awful people have been my ex-boyfriends, right? And some of the most incredible people in my life actually have been straight guys. And you know, I couldn't have come out at university the way I did if it hadn't have been for my straight male friends. And so Henry in the book was important for me. And there was pressure, 100%. Not from my publisher, but from earlier before the book sold, there was pressure on me say, oh, get rid of Henry. It doesn't work, you know. And I was like, no. He has to be in the story. It's important to have these different
allyship's important.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. And I, and but in their own way and on their own terms is okay too. And I also really feel as though there's a kind of unspoken, I don't know, it's like it's, we're doing ourselves a disservice by saying, if you're part of the queer culture, you're automatically good. And if you're not, you're bad. I'm like, that's not my experience in life. So that was important to me too, to tell this story in a way that felt real and relatable to other queer people. And not to be kind of simplistic or reductive about it. Because the truth is, if you look back at the research, sorry, just to finish the thought, if you look back at the research from the time, you know, it's quite clear that you had some rascals, you know, not all of the Mollies were like great allies and friends and were a chosen family. Some of them were rascals because it was a tough life back then. It was a cruel world, right?
And I think that actually... that's a really good point because they're human. Like it's a human nature to be good, to be evil, to be all these different things, to just 100%. Be a crappy human being. There are people like that. It doesn't matter what their sexual orientation or their races. It doesn't matter. And Molly and I, the other thing that I really like about this is like Molly and I talk a lot about people that include queer characters in their book so that they can be like, look, I have a gay. And we're like, we want there to be a substance, not just
a reason. Like, we don't need a gay aunt just to have a gay aunt in a book, right?
Right.
We understand the importance. I, as a person that took a long time to be honest with herself, a person that needed those representations young, I feel that it's important for visibility.
Yeah.
I also feel that you don't just throw a fucking gay character in a book just so you can say you have a fucking gay character.
Yeah.
It's disrespectful to the whole movement and the whole reason we do gay stories.
Yeah.
Can I say gay more? Gay.
I think you said it enough. And gay. And you don't know this about me, AJ. But you don't know this about me, AJ, but I go to church every Sunday. I am very into my faith. And I get asked a lot as a librarian, because, you know, librarians, we're going to indoctrinate people. So stupid.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, it's part of the oath.
The oath we take is, here's your diploma. We don't have an oath, but we do have a Bill of Rights in American Library Association. And our number one tentpole of our Bill of Rights is that we provide all access to all sides of all stories. But I get asked this a lot, like, as a Christian, how can you support, you know, sharing queer books, especially with kids and teens? And I'm like, because they have queer parents, because they are queer, like, because they need to see themselves, because my boys, who I'm assuming are hetero, and they're white men, they need to see people who do not look like them in a normal environment so that they learn empathy.
Yep.
And for me, that is what's important. I'm an ally. I'm not queer, but I mean, I like the dick.
But she's
the first
person to defend my ass. If somebody starts saying, well, she's married to a man, she's the first person to be like, yeah, and?
She's bi, so that is one of the genders. So I don't understand what the problem is.
Well, it's great. Right. You know, it's great. It's really important to have librarians such as yourself who really feel that, you know, it's important to give young people and children books that help to explain the world around them. I think children are much, much more aware than we give them credit for. And I think the problem for some straight people in understanding the importance of books that talk openly about different relationships is that it's so immediately about sex, and it's not about sex, right? You know, it's about, I mean, if there's a book that is about puberty and stuff, then fine, but no one is saying let's give some children some porn. It's about saying people exist, people love, people have, you know, and any more than a book about a mummy and a daddy who go to the zoo with their child, that's not a book about sex. That's a book about a family. And I think, you know, it's about detaching this instant thing of, you know, connecting your sexuality and your romantic relationships instantly with a particular sexual act, which, yep, by the way, the particular sexual act that men in the 1700s were being hanged for is a sexual act that actually is, you know, I'm talking about sodomy, is carried out by loads of straight couples. And it was then, right, you know, and the sodomy act that was brought in by Thomas Cromwell, who people might know from Wolf Hall, you know, Hilary Mantel, was Henry VIII's right-hand man, brought in the Sodomy Act, and it didn't actually distinguish. It didn't say it's you know, potentially a capital offence if you are two men who engage in sodomy per se. It was talking about sodomy as a thing. So, but of course, the only people who got in trouble for it were men. You know, the world has always been so confused about what its problem actually is. What is the actual issue? And I don't think, I've never spoken to anyone who can really put it into terms, other than coming back to the usual things of it's not natural, or what, you know, the usual boring phrases.
That turn of phrase. It's abnormal. Well, I came out the womb abnormal, and you don't see me getting in trouble. So, I mean, I do, but that's a whole nother ball of wax.
And you have this, it's really minor in the story, but I literally laughed out loud when I read it. There is a lavender couple in your book, because there is a man and a woman who are married, and the man is one of the Mollies, and the woman says that she, I don't even remember how the phrasing was, but I was like, oh, she just said she likes women. And I was like,
got it.
I love that you picked up on that. And actually, can I say thank you? Because I could tell from your messages, and I can tell from this, like, you're a really close, sensitive reader. And, you know, there are times when I'm writing when I almost think, like, should I put that in, or do I need to make this more obvious? And I don't want to. I like having the kind of half meanings and the shaded truths in there. And it's talking to folks like you that made me think, no, I need to carry on, you know, with
you
know, even if only like one person in 20 picks up on that little line or that little joke, then that's job done, right? So thank you. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad. Honestly, the line that broke me the most as the mother of two boys was when Gabriel says, you know about him, and his mom is like, yeah, I know what he is. He's my son. And I started sobbing. And that's not even that far into the book. I was just like, I mean, this is totally not at all the same. I realize that. But my oldest son is autistic. And that's like the least interesting thing about him. And when people are like, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm like, why? He's pretty awesome. Like, he's a straight A student. The kid is fucking brilliant.
And he's aware of it and doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. He'll be like, I'm autistic, I don't care. And literally, for me, like, I'm his mom. I love everything about him. And, you know, if he grows up someday and tells us that he's gay, he doesn't like anybody right now. So that's the tism coming out. But, you know, I'm still going to love him because I'm his mom. And that's the least interesting thing about him.
Yeah, that story, that little story that you have there is one of the little subplots, I suppose. Each of the characters, each of the Mollies has their own little story going on in the background. Yeah. And it takes your imagination, I suppose, to fill in the gaps, because I would have loved to have written that book 300,000, 400,000 words, right?
Of course.
But, you know, I have to kind of keep it punchy and keep it choppy and try and kind of keep the main plot moving forward. But that was just kind of one important scene where I thought, you know, because that character, George Lavender, up until that point is probably the least likable. I thought we need to kind of understand where he's coming from or why he is the way he is. Why is he so defensive? Why so paranoid? Why bitter? Why jealous? And so for me, giving him that story was important, you know, because it's something.
I was rooting for him to be the rat too. I'm an ass.
Yeah, well, as he may be, right? I mean,
We don't know.
We don't know. I'm sorry. Okay.
Questions, so friends? We've not gotten to any of the questions, but we've answered a lot of my questions already. But I do want to try to, like, rein us back in. Track. But we're having an amazing conversation. All right, so this is your second book, but this is the first one that was released in the US, correct?
Correct.
And what was the process of being published internationally like? Did you have to make any changes to make it more accessible for the US audience?
No, my publisher is Canadian, and mm-hmm. so kind of has a kind of very strong sense of the North American market. And right. so I had to kind of, I call it decudgeling. So penises in the 1700s are called cudgels, as a kind of, a cudgel mm-hmm. was something you hit people over the head with. So I guess mm-hmm. that works. And so I had to take quite a few, I had to take, get a view into my sex life.
Oh man.
I had to take, I had
I
to.
Love you. Come back always.
I had to pull out a lot of cudgels. Mm-hmm. And so we made it, I think it could have been, I think the draft before the last draft was maybe a little bit more explicit. And I was kind of not sure whether I wanted mm-hmm. to do that. But part of the reason for doing that, I think, was to take into account perhaps a slightly more socially conservative, small C America.
Yeah.
That being said, though, actually, when I started removing my cudgels, I realized that actually it was allowing the kind of the sensitivity of the yeah. romance mm-hmm. to breathe and to exist in a way that mm-hmm. wasn't it. I wasn't trying to shock anyone, and I wasn't trying to surprise anyone, and I wasn't trying to titillate, because the yeah. book is, if you want to read spice, then mm-hmm. there are lots of options for that. There's like yeah. dinosaur Facts. Sex, unicorn sex.
I'm sure April's got a list.
Right. I don't have a list. Our friend Katie has a list.
Crack and porn. Like,
you can go to, you can go to that. You can go to those books. My book isn't. My book does have a couple of sex scenes in it, but they're written in quite a nuanced way. I like to think quite a poetic way, because it's about the feeling and the emotion and the sense of these two guys who are so messed up somehow coming together. Mm-hmm. for want of a better phrase, literally and figuratively, mm-hmm. while kind of facing this huge danger. And I didn't want to trivialize that.
Of course not, because they were going through something terrible and hard, and trying to find this line of
And there are MM romances, if people are looking for that, that are open door in the spices there, and there's much more descriptive, but that wasn't the point of this book.
No.
And as much as this book like broke me in so many ways, there's so much humor in it. I laughed a lot. It was
a lot.
I don't know that I would say all of it was a good time, because there are parts that are really hard and heavy, but like I enjoyed reading this.
Anytime and they called each other bitches,
I laughed out loud.
The audiobook every time. Narrator, the audiobook narrator is like, by the way, and
you bitch, and I was dead.
You bitch. I know. Oh, okay. We're still bitches. Get it.
Yeah, there's like a line that made me laugh in them. And I didn't want to kind of overcamp it as well, because it's quite kind of pantomime in places. And I researched pantomime when I was writing it. But there were some bits just like the interactions that they have. And I think when Thomas is given the name Verity True Tongue in the Molly House, and I think it's Vivian Guzzle, because for people who don't know, right, Molly's in 1700s London gave each other kind of drag names, mm-hmm. really, is what we would call them now. So, you know, a real name, the Duchess of Camomile was a real name from a 1700s Molly. Another one called Old Fish Hannah, which I think is hilarious. You know that Old Fish Hannah was either like a toothless elderly gentleman with a wrinkly face, or I reckon Old Fish Hannah was like David Beckham. I think they were just so jealous of this good-looking bitch. They're like, right,
probably like ugliest. A fisherman that had like stacked body, right? And they were just pissed that he looked so good from fishing.
Yeah,
like,
oh look, here's Old Fish Hannah trolling him.
Probably smelled like a little bit like the docks, right? Because he probably just came from work.
Oh man, I'm just picturing I think David Beckham now.
It's Vivian Guzzle, isn't it, who's like, I think she says to Thomas Walker, she's called Verity True Tongue, heaven help the bitch.
Yes.
And it's just like, that's a good chapter ending, I like that, next, right, done.
There is very light moments in here, but it doesn't take away, like, there you have a good balance. You have a great mm-hmm. balance. And that's yeah. hard for any author. So kudos.
All right. So this book follows several Mollies in London in 1715, including what I consider, I'm not sure if you would consider them, but I consider Thomas and Gabriel to be kind of the main characters of the book.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And these characters are really in different stages of, like, quote unquote, coming yeah. out or accepting their sexuality. And what is something you would hope readers would take away from their individual journeys?
Oh, there's lots, isn't there, about being true to yourself and not, you know, having the bravery to confide. And I think it is bravery. That's not to say that people who don't confide and don't come out aren't brave. But I think mm-hmm. for those who do, it's still a scary thing. I think there are a lot of people who think, oh, those days are over. It's easy now. It isn't. Yeah. And it's got to be worth the risk. Otherwise, none of us would do it is how yeah, I feel right. about it. It's not to put pressure on anyone. But I think, you know, it's a slightly subtle thing, I guess, to say. But actually what I found really useful and cathartic when I was writing the book, and I think it's something that gay men and women really share, particularly with each other, but maybe I'm doing an injustice to straight guys here, because, you know, maybe they're exactly the same. But it's how differently we see ourselves and how cruel we are to ourselves, and how we just cannot understand how others see us. And mm-hmm. and so you have this book told through the points of view of Thomas, who talks about himself as this very spindly, weak guy, and mm-hmm. Gabriel, who talks about himself as this big, ungainly, ugly, hairy guy. Mm-hmm. And then about a third of the way through the book, you start, then they meet, and you then start mm-hmm. to see both characters through the other's eyes. Yeah. And Gabriel transforms into this powerful, handsome, mm-hmm. safe bear of a man who's gorgeous mm-hmm. and beautiful, with shining skin. And Thomas transforms into this lithe, athletic, you know, Greek statue, right?
Sweet boy.
But with a sweetness and a kind of a slightly yeah. kind of irritating naivety, but very lovable at the same time.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. But that was important for me. I suppose if you talk about what a reader might take from it, I think the more we can encourage ourselves and remind ourselves that the way we see our own bodies and who we are isn't the way other people perceive us, and mm-hmm. to give ourselves a break sometimes, actually, and to, when someone else says you look great today, or you're pretty, or you're doing great things, or I admire you, to just actually accept that and take it for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's hard.
Yeah. And I related to Thomas in the religious trauma. Growing up in a youth group in the 90s, the religious trauma surrounding sex in general, Molly and I just talked about this a few weeks ago, how I was literally told in my youth group that if I masturbate, I would become a lesbian, because I would start liking women, that would be what would happen. And hearing Thomas's story, I'm like, that's absolutely absurd. But hearing that's Thomas's story works, where he's being told, you're so wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and him finding acceptance with people who are like him, but he's still kind of an outsider. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I really liked his story, because religious trauma is fucking real.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I've ever suffered religious trauma as such, but I know people who have, you know, really struggled with parents who have been very unsupportive, mm-hmm. and the kind of scar that leaves is a lifelong yeah. thing. But, you know, also, you know, Thomas comes to London, he's got that expectation that because I'm going to meet these other Mollies and they're like me, therefore they're automatically going to be nice and they're going to be my family. And, you know, I've seen a number of times since I was a kid and I came out, you know, when I was a teenager, mm-hmm. And I had that exact same expectation. That mm-hmm. brings a risk with it too. You know, like if you yeah. know your parent, if you know someone is phobic, then you know where they are, you know, kind of a boundary, and you can hopefully you can separate yeah. from that as far as you need to, for as long as you need to. The danger comes, I think, when people think, oh, because we are the same in this sense, therefore you're going to look after me and you're going to care for my feelings. I've seen people, and I've been one of those people who gets chewed up and spat out, you know, and mm-hmm. that's kind of, it makes you so desperate to try and cling on to someone yeah. looking for love and acceptance and safety, that brings with it a risk, right? You can put yourself in real danger. And I see young people coming to London, very young people, younger and younger coming to London, right? And and I, you know, I kind of sometimes want to say to them, listen, just look after yourself, right? Yeah. You need to be safe, okay?
Yeah.
I feel that.
And Thomas does put himself in some precarious situations where,
exactly.
I mean, there's a potential for a sexual assault at one point. And, you know, fortunately that doesn't happen. But, he doesn't really understand, like you said, not everybody is good just because they're queer.
I can relate to this on a different level. I was active duty for several years in the Coast Guard. And just because you wear the same uniform as somebody doesn't mean that they're always out for your best interest. They're not always there to take care of you. And the military, when I was active, the Coast Guard pushed, trust your shipmates. Your shipmates are going to take care of you. 90% of the essays and assaults and rapes I saw while working were blue on blue. Because just because they're in your home doesn't make them family.
Well, this is why, you know, this is why it takes time and wisdom and, you know, experience to try and get a better sense of who you can be safe with and who you can trust. And that's why, you know, Gabriel's an older guy, not massively older, maybe 7 or 8 years older. But he's also older in his years. He's grown up in London, whereas Thomas hasn't. He's known the Mollies for many, many years. Thomas hasn't. And, you know, in my life, I've had a couple of Gabriels in my life who are not, they're not in it for sex or for anything else or money or whatever it is. They're friends. They're real friends. Yeah. And they've kind of kept me safe. And so, you know, it's about passing that on, isn't it? There's a lot of responsibility there to say, okay, you're new to this and it's all very exciting, but you need to tread carefully.
And I'm going to protect you, but you got to take care of yourself too.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, you have to protect them and protect yourself at the same time. But all of these experiences, which are very contemporary to us, and these themes and ideas are also very, very relevant to then. And so, yes, I think for me, the best historical fiction that I read, that other people write, is where they're not writing these characters as though they're somehow different species. Like, you could go back 2,000 years and it's the same, we're the same animal, we're the same people, with the same thoughts and feelings, the same worries, the same dreams. Technology is different, clothing's different, language is different, but we're still human beings. So, you know, I think historical fiction, weirdly, transversely, it's in the past, but actually historical fiction, I think, is the best predictor of the future.
It's such a great mirror.
For the real world.
Agreed.
Well, agreed. Part of the reason why I am not an avid reader of historical fiction is because I feel like the market is saturated with the woman looking away, World War II story, long lost love. And my favorite book of all time is historical fiction. It's To Kill a Mockingbird. And that is a book right there that no matter what time period I've read it, I read it for the first time as a sophomore in high school. And I've read it multiple times since. I used to teach it to freshmen in high school. Each time period, you still see the same shit happening. And it's like, she wrote this book in the 60s about something that happened in the 40s and we're still fucking doing that. So how do we make this better? So that is why I gravitated towards your book, because I feel like your book has that same message. Like, we should not still be fucking doing this.
Why?
Like, we should know this is absurd. So
agreed.
Anyway, yeah,
it's timely, you know, it is timely. Yeah. That's why I wanted to kind of try and get it right. I think any book that's talking about people who are different facing the kind of banal evil of power, and it's the banal you need to watch out for. If someone's shouting and making a lot of noise, then you can see them. It's what's frightening is when, you know, the steamroller of bureaucracy is employed and actually it becomes this slow, steady weight that crushes things. And I think that's where that's kind of
getting room in your loft. You can come for a visit.
We may need to be expats at some point.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you'll be coming to the wrong country, I think, if you were to come to Britain, because, you know, the steamroller is here too. Mm-hmm. The rise in homophobia and general, you know, bigotry in this country is really quite terrifying, and it's happening.
That's disgusting. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Anyway, but you know, that's part of the reason why I love writing this book. But fundamentally, it is for me an adventure and a love story, and I loved writing it. Kind of tricking my favorite chapter to write actually was kind of, well, I won't say when, but it's from the rat point of view.
Yeah.
There's only one chapter from the rat's point of view, mm-hmm. and I loved writing it because I could just tell that I was toying with the reader. I knew. I was like, I know what you're looking for, and I know what you're mm-hmm. trying to look for, and I know what you think you're seeing, and maybe you are, but maybe you're not. And I love playing around with language like that. It really made me smile.
That chapter made me very angry.
Major angry.
It's disrespectful, AJ.
Yeah, I was angry. I was like, just tell me. All right, so let's talk about.
It was when he left Bedlam, and he's like, I know who it is. And then chapter. You man.
All right, so this book is rooted in underground tradition of the Mollies and in Mother Claps, which was a real place, right? That was a real historical place.
Awesome.
The Mollies use different names and refer to each other as she, her. So this is actually a question that I messaged you and you were like, you should ask me that. So can you explain to our readers the distinction, how this distinction was significant to the Mollies, and how does it compare to like sexual and gender identity today?
Okay, it's a really big question. And the first thing that we need to understand, and it's very difficult to try and get our heads around, is that the idea of sexuality then is not the way it is today. There was no mm-hmm. there was no sense of gay and straight and bisexual and other mm-hmm. identities. It was kind of accepted that a lot of men had mm-hmm. sex with other men. Mm-hmm. Boys had sex when they were what we today call teenagers, when they were at school. I don't know, younger. Mm-hmm. in different ways. I don't want to, you know, it's so difficult to talk about it with the terminology and getting language right. But anyway, the point being, and then men might have, as in some cultures actually around the world today, they will have a wife they have children with, and mm-hmm. they might have a guy that they mess around with. That doesn't necessarily make you this sexuality or that sexuality. So there was a much kind of less rigid sense of this is my identity, this is who I am. So that's the first thing that we need to understand. There was no concept of homosexuality, really. Mm-hmm. There were men who messed around with men, and that was sinful, but there was a lot of sin, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
So for most of the time, sodomy was on paper, on the books, illegal, but it was never enacted because people, frankly, didn't have the time or the energy or the money to take it to court. Mm-hmm. The change came about with the Society for the Reformation of Manners, which was this organization that was sponsored by and paid for by the wealthy people in the world, who decided, okay, we're going to cleanse London, mm-hmm. we're going to cleanse England of this sin. And so they paid for these mobs to go around arresting guys and putting them through the courts and hanging them. But to go back to your original question, your Molly was someone who kind of went beyond just playing around, I guess. Mm-hmm. Generally, you know, Mollies would be maybe curious, they might go there, but it was a society. Mm-hmm. They had real friendships. They had lifelong relationships. They mm-hmm. gave each other these identities. And I think in a very patriarchal world, it was a way to express a part of themselves that men weren't allowed to express at the time.
Yeah.
You know? And so were they drag? Were they trans? Were they genderqueer in some way or other? Were they, you know, what were they? The truth is we don't know. And yeah. We'll never know, because the guys then, and I say guys then, mm-hmm. were just born of a different world where they had the same emotions and feelings, but a different upbringing, a different understanding of who they were. So I've answered that really clumsily, but I suppose the point I'm making is that it's impossible for us to say who they were.
Yeah.
All we know is what we are given from these court transcripts. So we know that they were in love. We know that they were friends. We know that they were having sex. We know that they were, not all of them, but a lot of them were dressing in women's clothing and finery, that they were playing matriarchal roles. So you'd have the midwife and you'd have the duchess and you'd have the queen and you'd have the whore and you'd have this and that and the other. They were using language that was their own kind of proto-language, which predates something called Polari, which is a British gay language that was used and is still used, but was mainly used up until about the 1970s, 1980s, that had a link with the criminal underworld secret language. Dolly meant pretty, eek is your face, your legs are your lallies, an Omi is a man, a Polone is a woman, you know, these words. So you could kind of have full conversations about things without actually ever having to be understood by the authorities. Does that answer sort of the question that you're asking?
Yeah.
And that was super interesting. I love the secret language stuff.
I feel like just like any sort of like secret society, they have rituals in the Molly house too. Like there was the birthing and the marriage, and I mean, these were their rituals into their society. I just thought that was really an interesting way to look at it, because we have such a... I'm sorry.
I was just going to say there's a historical text, actually, I've got over here in a bag, but I don't need to read the whole thing. But basically, it describes a tavern, just a normal tavern. So people just there drinking, going about their normal lives. And you have a group of mollies who are there. And the writer's writing very kind of askance about it. But it describes the mollies. One is dressed as a midwife and one is, you know, the wife and the mother and the pregnant lady. And they have a jointed wooden baby doll. And they act out giving birth to this baby doll. And they're kind of putting on a show. But, so it is incredible looking back, actually, that it was in plain sight as well.
Yeah.
It just shows that we have been denying letting people be who they are for a long time, right? It's this, obviously, they had these urges that they needed and wanted to be something more than just a man, right? They didn't want this structure, and to see this over and over again in history. We see it in Egypt. We've seen it in the Mayans. We see it constantly. Like even the natives here, like in North American, Native American language, there is language for a third gender. There is language for men that dress as women. Like we have always seen this. This has always been here. And yet we still have this underlining hate and rage towards it for no reason. It's just... this is why this book's important, because we keep freaking reminding people it's never not been this way.
And AJ, you and I have a mutual friend. We know her through TikTok and chatting that way, but Dr. Susie Edge, who I love and I'm slightly obsessed with her. And I actually messaged her while I was reading this book and asked her if she had ever done any videos on queer monarchs. And she's like, I get asked this question a lot. I don't feel like it's my place to say it. Here are two creators that I really like that do this. And so I'm going to put them in our description below to go follow them.
Bless Sue.
In our maybe first season, we read Red, White, and Royal Blue, which is a favorite book of mine. I'm actually rereading it right now because we're doing it for my book club at the library where I work. And by the way, I work in a really small rural county in Virginia. I was shocked. I was like, hey, how about we do a pride book? They were like, yes. I was like, Yes. So we're doing that,
baby.
We have one man in our book club, and he was like, "Yeah, I don't want to read about two men." And I was like, "That's fine. You don't have to read this one if you don't want to."
Is it your elderly gentleman?
Yes, he's 79 years old. He came into the library and told me, "I want the books with the sex in them." I was like, "I got you, sir."
He's hilarious. You got it, guy.
I was like, I gotcha. I read the books with the sex in them, so you've come to the right person. Anyway, I in that book, have you read Red, White, and Royal Blue, AJ?
Do you know, my closest friend loves that book. I have not yet read it. I'm actually so far behind on reading anything I want to read because I'm constantly researching, yeah. So it's nonfiction all the way.
We're constantly reading for pod, and I'm like, Molly, I just want to read about fairies fucking. I don't want to read this book anymore.
She's always on me about not finishing my work, and I'm like, but I gotta read for pod.
Like, just finish a fucking book, Molly.
I'm trying.
but so in that book, it's a British prince and the American first son, yes. And there's a lot of discussion about gay historical figures who were not out, for lack of a better term. And I just think it's really interesting because I had a discussion with Molly and our other friend Katie, and I was like, what would happen if there were a gay British monarch? And they're like, what do you mean if, April? What do you mean if? And I was like, that's fair. There probably has been.
Oh, yeah. Lavender marriages have been a long time.
Yes.
Yeah. They're, I mean, quite openly, but quite, it goes back to what I was saying before about our understanding of what it means to be gay or straight, you know, and how it was different then. I mean, you know, King James VI of Scotland, first of England, who followed after Queen Elizabeth I. I mean, he was pretty much as openly gay as you can be, you know, in his era. It wasn't something he hid. You know, French kings, they've been gay. There are examples throughout history of it. And prime ministers have been gay, you know, prime ministers of this country, that less well known, I guess. I mean, there's even there's actually quite a lot of evidence to show that Queen Victoria's husband, Prince Albert, may not have been gay, but might have been bi at least. But there's a lot of evidence that he was quite interested in men.
Everyone,
well, just anyone. Yeah, I mean, they had about 100 children, so I think he had quite a high sex drive. But no, but you're right. It's throughout history, and I think the more we learn about that, the better. Yeah. But I can also say, by the way, if you know, there could be a bad reaction to a guy in your book club saying, "I don't want to read about two men." I think that's perfectly valid. Like, we all have things that they make you feel a bit uncomfortable. Then that's fine, because you know, saying that isn't the same as saying, "I don't think they should be allowed to do it." It's just like, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know if that kind of presses the right button for me.
And he still is coming to the meeting. He still wants to come, even though he doesn't want to read the book. Like, he still wants to be the part of the conversation. He didn't like the first book that he read with us either, which was Bride by Ali Hazelwood, because he was like, I don't understand vampires and werewolves. Like, that's not for me.
He's 79. Give him grace. But I mean, you need to give him Twilight.
But it's funny, you know, I was talking actually only this morning to a guy who there's a church I'm researching for the next novel. And I was talking to him, and he was saying, I wasn't sure I wanted to read the book, but my, you know, friend who's also at the church said it was very good. And he ended up really, really liking it, when his expectation was that he wouldn't, because it was about Molly's. He was like, well, I'm not going to like that book then. And actually he surprised himself. And I've heard that a lot, actually. People who might have considered themselves to be kind of a little bit more closed to the nature of the book than they actually are in reality.
Well, and I think part of that is because this is a story about history, and even though there are people having sex in it, it's not about sex. I think that the part that most people who are uncomfortable with it would be uncomfortable with, the sex side of it. It's not the story. Like, I mean, I think that's still absurd, but you know, that's where we are. But the man is 79. He likes the books with the sex in them. So what am I going to do?
We actually talked about this on the last night at the Telegraph Club, because we were uncomfortable in that book. Mm-hmm. They call her China doll. Mm-hmm. They use derogatory language towards her and other people of color. And that's the point of historical fiction.
It's the context of the book. Yeah.
you're supposed to be mildly uncomfortable because this is not how we react now. This is not how we behave now.
It and stretches you.
That's yes. Thank you.
So sometimes I have words. All right.
And sometimes I don't.
So I know we've taken up a lot of your time. So I want to just ask, can you tell us what's next for you? I know you've posted some research pictures on your Instagram recently, which, by the way, we'll link the social media following below. Also, where can Americans purchase your first book? Because they're going to want to after they've read this.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's a good question. I believe, so there's, there are links in my social media bio, and if you scroll down, you can find links to buy The Spirit Engineer. And I think one of the Spirit Engineer links is for a shop called Blackwells. And Blackwells, I believe, still do free international shipping, completely free international shipping. Or basically,
do it now before tariffs start coming in. Do it now.
Right, well,
put the links in there, guys. I'll do the thing for you.
So there's that. I mean, I say it's completely free, or it's the same as it would be for the UK or something like that. But anyway, it's not so expensive. So that's an option. You can buy The Spirit Engineer. You can't get it on US from the kind of the Rainforest website. I thought you could.
That I don't know. I know you can't get it on Amazon unless you're on the UK Amazon.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. So I don't know exactly kind of how that works, but anyway, try Blackwells, I would say.
Yes. And I do know you can get it there because I went to the page from your website to see how much it was to ship it.
Fabulous. Okay. Good stuff.
Can confirm.
And it's a great, and just quickly, that is, that's the story based again on a true story. So that's what I do. I take a true story that's been forgotten. I bring it back to life. That's the true story of William Jackson Crawford, who in the early 1900s, in Belfast, when they've just heard that the Titanic has sunk, he becomes the world's most famous spirit medium investigator. And he meets Harry Houdini.
Oh, that's my vibe.
Yeah, and
so it's very much a Molly book, by the way. I read the description. I'm going to find it. Oh, my gosh, Molly would love it.
So there's a lot of seances and ghosts, and are the ghosts real or are they fake? And, you know, that kind of stuff. So and I loved researching that. So you can get that way. Please do.
Yay.
And what's up next for you? You're searching for a third book?
Yes, absolutely. So my first nonfiction book, I think, is going to be out in spring next year. And that is the history of queer bookshops around the world since the beginning of time.
That's
awesome.
Oh, that's freaking cool.
And I tell you what, some of those stories are hilarious, heartbreaking, and terrifying as well. So that's going to be really cool. And then the next book.
That's your sweet spot.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Great.
Yeah, exactly.
You guys didn't know. We like to screw you up.
The next book, what can I tell you? It's based on a true story. It's Victorian, but it might be a kind of flashback Victorian from a more contemporary time. And it's a story about kind of mortality and about murder. And it's a mystery, and there's going to be, I think there's going to be quite a big twist in it, and it's going to be creepy and hopefully funny and vivacious. It's kind of set in theatre land, so it's kind of got that lovely, rich Victorian theatrical lighting and the red velvet.
I'm here for it.
I mean, who doesn't love
to bring it back?
Who doesn't love it? An empty theater in the middle of the night with the lights off. You can't get any more
spooky. Phantom of the Opera was,
I was going to say,
mine for a long time.
So that's
going to be a kid if you can't tell.
So that's going to be very cool, but I've got to write it first.
Well, yeah, happy researching and happy writing.
I feel that.
Are you under contract for it?
Yes. So it's going to be with Arenda Books, the same brilliant publisher as the last one. So it's going to be, we know one thing, it's going to look beautiful.
Fantastic.
Yeah, they're going to do a great job. And the research for that is coming along great. I mean, I just look down the side here, the side of this bed, and there's honestly a pile bed height of books that I'm currently reading. Autobiography.
I have a stack of nonfic I'm working on right now. I feel you.
Yeah. It's great. You have this kind of mix of like you read something, you think, oh, wow, that's an amazing detail. That has to go in the book. And then I think, oh, my gosh, that's an amazing detail. How am I going to get that in the book?
It's that rabbit hole you get in where you're just like digging through this and you're like, I can't put all of this in, but I need this information to be important to everyone.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know how to explain that as a writer.
So we love asking this question, and we'll just put this out there and then we can wrap up unless you have more. But are you a pantser or a plotter? You do a lot of research, but how do you actually go about the writing?
With the first two books, I was a plotter, but then I kind of realized that I think I needed to have a little bit more faith in the story and my own ability as a writer to be guided. I was I've been lucky enough to talk to Patricia Cornwell, who's very famous author indeed, and she said, you know, the stories will come and find you, and you need to open your laptop or sit down with your paper and just say to your characters, what are you going to do today? And so I'm going to, with the third one, I think, you know, the research has given me lots of ideas, but you know, with Thomas True, I wrote that book three times from scratch. The first time was 160,000 words. The second was 80,000 words. The third draft was 110,000 words. And when I tell you that every single draft was from scratch, completely new, I deleted the whole, well, I didn't delete, but I moved on from the whole thing and started afresh. And I needed to go through that process, partly because I now realize in hindsight, partly because the first time I was trying to write and the second time I was kind of trying to write to a plan. And the truth is that when I'm planning, I don't know who the characters are yet because I haven't met them. So, you know, it's like trying to arrange, a holiday for people you know nothing about, right? You've got to
It's getting your invisible friends to talk to you.
Yeah.
Right. It's getting the invisible friends to talk to you. It's like, can you just give me a little bit more detail, guy? Because I'm drowning here and just waiting for you to give me words.
So I think you hit it right. Like I'm a researcher, but I think I'm going to be less of a plotter.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
One last question. Okay. Actually,
so Molly's going to make me ask this. Have you read Twilight? Because the question is relevant to Twilight.
It's a vampire question in general.
Right.
We ask all authors this because we question Stephanie Meyer.
For a lot of reasons. Do vampires have sperm?
I hope so.
That might be my favorite answer.
You know what? Emma Berry, move to the side. AJ West just won.
Oh my gosh.
I hope Emma Berry said that Edward Cullen's just had one in the chamber.
One in the chamber, and that was the child that was conceived. They're dead. How? I mean, are they like walking around with erections all day because they're like cold and frozen and like stone? Like, I don't know. It seems uncomfortable.
The math doesn't math. That's why we ask everyone.
I haven't read Twilight, but I have read Interview with the Vampire, and I love the latest TV series, the two TV series.
Oh, it's so good.
I think it's just brilliant. And actually, that series really influenced some of the writing in Thomas True, the first series, because the second one hadn't come out yet. But there's a scene early on in the first series where they're having a really violent argument and fight in a church surrounded by candles. And if you read the chapter where Gabriel and Thomas have an argument in a church, like that was very much in my mind.
I see it now that you've said it. I see it now that you said it because that new show is so good.
Oh, I think it's just brilliant. It's so good. I think they, I definitely.
And
think
it's underrated. I'll put it in the links for our friends that haven't seen it.
I didn't even know there was a new one.
You're talking about the one on AMC?
Well, I don't know what it's on in the States, but it's you know, it's the amazing. I should know the actors' names, but it's kind of set in Old Orleans, New Orleans.
Yeah, Nola, and it's this writer who is following up with a man he met when he was a young man, and then he goes to Dubai to see him, and it's just,
It's wild. It's beautiful, and it's such a wonderful depiction of male love. Actually, I think it is,
and the conflict they deal with, and adding the danger of being discovered as a vampire, being a black man in Nola at that time.
AJ, was there anything else you wanted to share with our listeners?
Since we've consumed so much of your time today.
Yeah.
It is getting late for you.
I feel bad. Yeah, it's very late there.
I think the only thing I would share is that, you know, I'm passionate about my books. I want as many people to read them as possible. I love, it really helps me when people are telling me that they're reading the book. So if you're listening to this and you order the book and you find me on Instagram where I am more often than other ones, you know, don't be shy about sending a message and you know, mm-hmm. doing exactly what April did and saying, hey, I'm reading your book. And well, only if you're enjoying it. If you're not, I don't want to know. But if you're enjoying it, like, tell me.
I love it.
You know, I've got three different readers today who have sent me pictures of notes they've made in the book or a line they've really liked. Or one of the readers is neurodivergent and is drawing kind of scribble pictures of how they see the different characters in different scenarios. And I can't tell you how much I love that. I love interacting with my readers. It means a lot to me. So I guess that's what I'd want people to know. And I guess, I don't know whether it was you, April, who said this actually. There's someone on TikTok the other day, forgive me if it was you, but saying, I think it was you saying, why is no one's talking about this on TikTok? Why is no one talking about this book? You know, mm-hmm. and I guess there's two reasons. In no way was I offended, but it kind of hurts a little to hear because I'm the same. I'm like, yeah, why? You know, what do I have to do? I work really hard to try and spread the news about my writing. The truth is, there's so many writers out there.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, when the magic hand of TikTok reaches down and says, we shall make you a famous book. You know, a lot of people in publishing think you can buy that or you can engineer that. The truth is, you can't. It's the great thing about TikTok is the big books are decided on by the readers. And so
unfortunately,
I will say, I'm really sorry that offended you. But I will
it didn't offend me at all. You're totally right. I'm just saying that when you hear it, you're like, yeah, I know. I feel like that too. You know?
You're like, duh.
Well, I will say, unfortunately, a lot of books that Molly and I have covered specifically because they were trending on TikTok, we haven't enjoyed them. And I think a lot of that, I'm never going to begrudge somebody becoming a reader especially as an adult in discovering a love of reading again. But I read as an academic. And so I don't always enjoy books that others do because I want there to be a point. Like as a children's librarian, as a person is despicable, but Harry Potter is like, if you are a children's librarian, you better like Harry Potter. I can't stand it. I didn't like it before her politics. I don't like it because I don't think it's well written. And that's like sacrilege for a children's librarian.
She doesn't like Deborah Harkness.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I tried.
I know, AJ!
I'm sorry. I tried.
Well, we all have the controversial opinions. I'm not a big fan of Kylie Minogue, but you know, there we are.
Yeah.
But
I have beef with Colleen Hoover. I think abuse romance is like disgusting. So
yeah, but I think she's on her way out. I think all this with Blake
Deuces,
Lively.
Babes. Deuces.
This is not relevant. Okay.
Well, so let's get AJ.
AJ, thank you.
So he can go to bed.
I want to show what we're doing next week because next week is our season 8 finale and we are reading We Are the Match by Mary E. Roach, and this is an art copy. Thank you, Montlake, who is her publisher.
Yes.
This book doesn't actually go on sale until July. It is a modern retelling with family gangs of Helen of Troy. And,
yeah.
And it's a sapphic story, and I'm a little bit more than halfway through, and it's a good ride. I'm enjoying it.
I am too.
So that's what we've got coming up, and then we're going to take a long ass break for the whole summer. But Katie and I will be doing Smut Girl Summer. So if you're following us on Instagram, you can see our Smut Girl Summer. We plan to read lots of smut. It's going to be great for my brain. And Molly might join us for one of those. And We're going to be at Columbus Book Festival. This is huge, guys. 40,000 people come to the Columbus Book Festival. We will be there. That's exhausting. Two I'm an introvert. Panels. I don't know how we're going to do this.
We're hosting two panels. I don't know how I'm going to control the ADHD enough to sit still
that long. I'll control you. Don't worry about it. I'll tell Tom to turn your mic off. We have two panels, one on Saturday, one on Sunday. Plus, we're hoping to interview some other authors who will be there. And
I'm going to find you, Matt Dinneman. I'm going to find you.
Threatening our authors, okay?
It's a sweet threat. I love his book, doesn't know and I want him to love us. And he could love us.
Okay, well, you're a little crazy.
Sorry, the crazy girl eyes. I'm sorry.
And then we'll be back.
I'm really excited about that book.
In September with season 9. And we have some amazing guests lined up for season 9. And I'm going to share one of them because I'm so fucking excited because I've been trying to get her on for a few seasons. But Kelsey Navarra Foster,
yes!
The audiobook narrator who I love,
we will love be on. Her.
I'm so excited. So that's what
yes,
we got.
Yes, yes. Okay.
We will AJ, come. Thank you. You're amazing. Thank you so
come
much.
Back
you're
anytime.
Welcome back anytime.
You can read with us if you want, even. Like, yeah. It's a thing authors do.
Listen. Thank you very much, both of you. And you know why, particularly today, because you are very lovely and very patient and very kind. You've made me feel so welcome. And in the run-up, people should know this who are listening. There's a difference. There's podcasters and there's podcasters, right? And mm-hmm. I think the best podcasters, it's how you are treated in the run-up and mm-hmm. how you're looked after and how you're reassured. And you've made me feel so secure and confident
thank
and happy.
You.
And I just want to say thank you for that. You've been so professional and I'm really grateful.
Thank you.
I've never that been a professional day in my life. Thank you.
You managed it.
Woohoo!
All right, guys. Thank you, AJ. Thank you, AJ. So we'll see you next week.
See you next time,
bye. Thank you for joining us on Book Besties. Don't forget to like and subscribe. The views discussed here are those of April and Molly, not those of anyone else. Today's book was The Betrayal of Thomas True by our special guest, AJ West. Your book besties are Molly Biggs and April Watkins, editing by Thomas Watkins, and music is Sleep Sweetly by Prigida. Don't forget to follow the Book Besties on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube. If you'd like to contact the Book Besties, please email us at bookbestiespod@gmail.com or visit our website, bookbestiespodcast.com. You can also support the Book Besties by joining our Patreon at Book Besties Podcast. Until next time, besties, get lost in your favorite book.